Tuesday, colder yet partly sunny, daytime highs 10 below to 1 above, and evening lows near 30 below.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Hoping for the best, preparing for the worst. For the first time in living memory, the Canadian military has modeled what a U.S. invasion of Canada might look like. The reporter who broke the story says officials stress it is still very much a hypothetical scenario, and they hope it stays that way.
And wow now, brown cow. A very smart and frequently itchy cow has made her way into a scientific journal thanks to a researcher who was amazed by her varied use of a long-handled broom to get at those hard-to-reach places.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few moments here on KAXC. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. 10 o'clock, Malachi Coons on Headwaters, more great music. And today, during the 11 o'clock hour, you'll hear a conversation that Kari Hedlund had with Twin Cities DJ Mary Lucia about her new memoir, What Doesn't Kill Me Makes Me Weirder and Harder to Relate To. Support for KAXE comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. We also thank Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. We're going to listen now to our album of the week. It's Off the Fence by the James Hunter Six. This is the group's first album on Dan Auerbach's label Easy Eye Sound after years at retro soul label Daptone Records. In spite of moving labels, Hunter's longtime collaborator and Daptone's co-founder Gabriel Roth still produced this album. James Hunter is from England and has connected with music from the past since he was a teenager, informing his signature retro sound. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear this evening from the James Hunter Six is called Believe It When I See It.
One time bitten, the next time shy.
From our album of the week, that is the James Hunter 6, Believe It When I See It. That album is called Off the Fence. We'll be hearing lots more of it throughout the week, and you can let us know what you think. Text 218-326-1234. The American Red Cross is in need of blood and platelet donations to help keep supplies steady. You can find a blood drive near you at redcrossblood.org. We continue now with As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Good defenses make good neighbors. A Globe and Mail reporter reveals that for the first time in a century, the Canadian military has modeled a hypothetical U.S. invasion of Canada.
Speaking truth to power company, at a tense public meeting, a group of New Brunswickers expressed serious opposition to a planned new gas plant. A vice president of the utility tells us public support does matter, but so does keeping the lights on.
Burning questions. A reporter in Chile tells us how fire overcame one coastal community in the blink of an eye. And shocked locals are now wondering if this really is the new normal.
Hell on wheels. Truck drivers on one BC highway are going through a lot of major depressions, reporting potholes that have been described as the size of a small bathtub.
Leave no stone unturned. The tale of a small, strangely popular boulder in British Columbia called Portable, which is finally heading back to where it belongs months after it went missing.
And Legend Dairy. A new scientific paper introduces the world to a brilliant cow by the name of Veronica, who uses a broom to sweep away her itches in an incredible example of bovine tool use. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that assumes she just started from scratch. Today in Davos, Prime Minister Mark Carney delivered a stark warning that the times are very much a-changin'. In the face of U.S. threats to territories like Greenland, he said that we can no longer rely on a rules-based international order to protect us. Here's part of that speech.
Great powers can afford for now to go it alone. They have the market size, the military capacity, and the leverage to dictate terms. Middle powers do not. But when we only negotiate bilaterally with a hegemon, we negotiate from weakness. We accept what's offered. We compete with each other to be the most accommodating. This is not sovereignty. It's the performance of sovereignty while accepting subordination. In a world of great power rivalry, the countries in between have a choice. Compete with each other for favor or to combine to create a third path with impact. We know the old order is not coming back. We shouldn't mourn it. Nostalgia is not a strategy. But we believe that from the fracture, we can build something bigger, better, stronger, more just. This is the task of the middle powers. The countries that have the most to lose from a world of fortresses and the most to gain from genuine cooperation. The powerful have their power. But we have something too. The capacity to stop pretending, to name reality, to build our strength at home, and to act together. That is Canada's path. We choose it openly and confidently, and it is a path wide open to any country willing to take it with us. Thank you very much.
Mr. Carney didn't mention Donald Trump by name, but behind the scenes, the Canadian government is very focused on what the U.S. president might do next. The military is considering what it admits is a very unlikely, absolute worst-case scenario. As reported today by the Globe and Mail, leaders have modeled a hypothetical U.S. invasion of Canada. It's the first time in a century that the military has felt the need to play out such a scenario. The Globe's Robert Fife broke the story, and we reached him in Ottawa.
Robert, what's your understanding from your sources about when the military made this decision? What was the final straw?
I don't know whether there was a final straw. I think this is something that has been building over for a considerable period of time. And I think the accumulation of the rhetoric from Donald Trump and the people around him, not the military leaders. Of course, they don't agree with anything that he's doing in regard to that, because it's fracturing the NATO alliance and would fracture and destroy NORAD, which does continental defense. I think they realize, look, just to be prudent, to do a model of how we would respond to a potential U.S. invasion. This, by the way, the first time this has even been thought about in 100 years.
It's so striking, all of it, to us as we prepare to talk to you, your readers, no doubt, our listeners, as they hear what we're talking about. Did you get the sense that your sources were stunned that they're in this spot and doing this modeling as well?
Absolutely, because, and I have to say this, it's really important, is that, you know, they don't believe that the United States would invade Canada. And they understand that, you know, the majority of people in Congress value Canada as a security, defense, and economic ally. But the fact of the matter is, it would be irresponsible not to at least model this out. And it's important for your listeners to understand is that this is not a detailed military plan for a U.S. invasion. This is a hypothetical, conceptual view of thinking about what might happen if the United States did invade Canada.
It is really important that you underline all of that. As they do this modeling, what did they tell you about whether they feel Canada is equipped at this moment to fight a hypothetical U.S. attack or invasion?
Sadly, Canada is not equipped. We have allowed our military to deteriorate over the last 45 years, and they all say that Canada could not withstand a conventional war with the United States, that the Americans could probably defeat us with 2 weeks a week or even 2 days. What we would end up having to do would be to use the kind of insurgency tactics that the Afghan Mujahideen used against the Russians and later the Taliban used against NATO forces, including Canada, of which, as you well know, we lost 158 soldiers. Usually, most of those were through IEDs or insurgency attacks. We would also look at what the Ukrainians have done very successfully when Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022. They used drones, but also shoulder missiles that were able to take out Russian tanks, and they stopped them from taking over Kiev. So we'd have to look at insurgency tactics to be successful. As one of the officials said, this would be to cause maximum casualty to the Americans. So that is the one thing. And the other thing that everybody recognizes, too, is that, yes, the Americans could easily defeat Canada in a conventional war. But it's one thing to be able to do that. It's another thing to occupy a country 3,000 miles of length, and also with some major cities. Like Toronto's got 4 million, Vancouver 3 million, Montreal 3 million. These are not easily cities to be able to occupy. They don't have the forces to be able to occupy the country the size of Canada. I mean, Canadians would do all kinds of, on their own, I'm sure, sabotage tactics and whatnot to be able to show their displeasure with an American occupation, if, in fact, that ever happened, which I do not believe it will happen.
These are extraordinary times, extraordinary conversations we're having, including this one. In terms of why your sources wanted to share this information, I can see on one hand they might want to say, hey, we're very much taking this seriously. This is a very different moment in time, and we want to be as prepared as possible. But is there concern that by saying that at this point we're not equipped, that we're actually putting Canada in a weaker position?
I don't actually think so, because the Americans know that we're not equipped. The whole world knows that Canada's military has been allowed to deteriorate. And I keep saying that this is not something we should take seriously about an invasion, but it is prudent thinking on the behalf of the Canadian military to think about this. Mm-hmm. Look what happened, you know, early Tuesday morning when Trump posted on Truth Social a map showing Cuba, Venezuela, Greenland, and Canada as part of the United States. So, you know, sane Americans do not want to invade Canada. But unfortunately, the president keeps saying stuff that makes you feel that he wants to do this. And he's surrounded by people who also echo that. NBC News reported just over the weekend that the Americans, the people around Trump, see Canada as a hostile power. And Steve Bannon, who was his former chief strategist and is still whisperer in his ear, has also talked about, you know, taking over Canada. So the crazies are in charge of the White House, and some of them are thinking crazy things.
I want to ask you, because you write in your piece, conscription has been ruled out for now, but the level of sacrifice that would be asked of Canadians remains a central topic, according to the folks you spoke with. What do you want our listeners to know about that?
Well, first of all, Canadian Armed Forces is already trying to set up a plan to, and this is not a conceptual thing, this is a real plan, where they want to have a reserve force of 400,000 people. So we're not having conscription, but they're certainly wanting to have a very significantly sized a reserve force of 400,000, which is not going to be easy to build up over a short period of time, but it gives you a sense of where the thinking is with the within the Canadian military, and presumably within the Canadian government, that we have to do more militarily to prepare for any kind of eventuality.
Robert, I appreciate this. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Robert Fife is the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau Chief. That's where we reached him. First responders in Chile are still counting the dead today, while dozens of separate fires are still burning across the country. Already, fires in the Nuble and Biobío regions have killed an estimated 20 people and prompted the country's president, Gabriel Boric, to declare a state of catastrophe. Hundreds of homes have been destroyed and tens of thousands of people have been evacuated, and high summer temperatures mean the danger is far from over. Alexandra Villegas is a reporter for Reuters who's been covering the fires in the hardest-hit community of Penco, Chile. That's where we reached him.
Alexander, where exactly in Penco are you? What's happening around you?
So we're in Penco, right? It's a coastal city, so we're right on the coast at the base of where one of the deadly fires happened. A lot of the areas that burned were in the hills, kind of where the forests are, and there's this one specific area, Liriquén, which we're at the base of, which kind of suffered the highest amount of casualties. Currently, the police and military are kind of stopping people from going up into the most affected areas because they believe they've found more bodies and there are kind of more victims up in the area. So kind of where we are, there's still a few burned homes, but there's a lot of people, you know, just gathering supplies, parking their cars to bring up water, clothes, foods, shovels, and kind of anything that these people kind of need to help make it through the next few days. Something that I've heard people say is that, like, Chile ayuda Chile, which is like Chile helps Chile. So there has been a lot of kind of solidarity among these towns. A lot of businesses are closed, focusing on just like baking bread or bringing food to the people who've been affected.
What else are people telling you about the difficulties? That support is wonderful, and we often hear about communities coming together. But what did people tell you about how these flames moved in?
Yeah, everyone has been quite surprised by just the speed of it. One guy kind of compared it to lightning. They said that, you know, there's fires are quite common in this area historically, and they've said that, you know, they've seen them in the past, but they never seen it move with such ferocity or expected it to come in and actually hit their communities, because they're usually extinguished, you know, way before that happens. But this one person, Franco Camaño, told me that he noticed the flames kind of further down and started watering down his hose. His cousins live next door, and they started watering down their home too. But he said all of a sudden, the water just cut off, and then there was just like this black smoke vortex, an incredibly strong wind that made it impossible for him to do anything except run. The family left their pets in the home. Four of their dogs died. Some of their cats did too. And he said there was nothing they could do except run. And in the community we're at the base of now, the fire kind of reached them at 3 a.m. And a lot of them said that, you know, they just woke up and had no other option to just like run out in their pajamas. They couldn't grab anything except just kind of flee.
It sounds terrifying and incredibly, incredibly sad, Alexander. Were there warnings?
There were warnings. There were alerts. Some people told me that, you know, there had been some alarms going off, but they didn't expect it. They didn't expect the speed of it, because the community that got hit at 3 a.m, they thought that they were kind of safe after a certain hour. And they knew that there was fires around, but it just came in just so quickly. And, you know, I've spoken to some climate scientists, and this is similar to what happened in Valparaiso here 2 years ago when 120 people died, and kind of in the Australia fires, the LA fires. Which we're kind of seeing more with climate change, with extreme heat and these fast winds, that the fire just advances at such a kind of shocking speed that people, even if you know it's kind of coming, the speed at which it actually hits and moves through the community leaves people very little time to react.
In terms of government response and help, we know Chile's president declared a state of emergency in the affected regions. But the mayor where you are in Penco, Rodrigo Vera, said that, as of yesterday, there was no government presence there. What is it like now?
So we've seen a lot of military and police deployment. There has been a curfew. They're mostly, in charge of keeping order. Keeping certain roads, let's say to come into Lirken, they weren't letting people who don't live in the community in. We were pressed, so we were able to pass through. Also, you know, the state coroner's office, firefighters are quite present. But most of the help for communities and citizens we're seeing is coming from, you know, the community and individuals. I still haven't seen the state kind of response when it comes to handing out water and other supplies to people. There are some shelters, government shelters that have been activated, but yeah, most of the state presence we've seen has been kind of police and military.
You mentioned the fires just 2 years ago. Have people even been able to rebuild after those?
Yeah, so that's kind of been a big criticism of the government in Valparaiso, the slow rebuilding of it, and a lot of people still haven't gotten their homes after the devastating fires there, and it has been kind of a thorn in the government's side and something that they've been kind of widely criticized about. But now we have a new government coming in. You know, far-right José Antonio Kast has been elected, and he assumes power in March. So kind of the reconstruction efforts will probably land on his government.
And what's their position on these kinds of fires and climate impact, climate change?
Yeah, kind of like other far-right governments in the region and around the world, they've been, you know, not really focused on the environment. Down here in southern Chile, there's lots of forestry companies and, you know, that grow pine and eucalyptus that, you know, help feed fires. They're highly combustible. And, you know, the José Antonio Kast and his government's a proponent of the forestry industry. But they met with Boric's government about these fires, and they've kind of, you know, they've put in, put together a message of solidarity that both governments are working together. So when it comes to the response, they've kind of been united in that they're going to provide as much support as they can. But when it comes to policies, let's say about protecting the environment or what to do to prevent forest fires, that's still kind of yet to be seen.
Alexander, I appreciate this. Thank you, and please take care.
Okay, thank you.
Alexander Villegas is reporting on Chile's wildfires. For Reuters, we reached him in Penco, Chile. Thank you. A paper recently published in Current Biology begins by describing a cartoon in which a cow stands behind a table of bizarre tools. The caption is, "Cow Tools." It doesn't really help to see it. It's confusing. But cartoonist Gary Larson has explained that that is kind of the point. A cow using tools is absurd. Well, no one told Veronica, not that she understands language, she's a brown Swiss pet cow who lives a life of luxury in the picturesque Austrian Alps. And she has been captured many, many times on video using a tool, specifically a broom, which she uses to scratch those hard-to-reach spots, which on a cat was the vast majority of spots. Antonio Osuna Mascaro is the co-author of the study on Veronica and a cognitive biologist at the University of Veterinary Medicine, Vienna. That's where we reached him.
Antonio, I have to say, I don't think I ever imagined taking so much joy from watching a video of a cow in Austria just, you know, doing its thing. Do you get joy from watching it still?
Oh, well, of course. I really enjoy my stay there with Veronica, not only because the place was wonderful, of Veronica's owner, Vidgar Vigele, was really nice with us. Yeah. But also because Veronica was nice. You know, dealing with a cow is a bit like dealing with a cat. Once you earn her trust, then she behaves in a really social way with you. And that was really nice as well.
Yeah, I bet. I bet Veronica is special, though, I think. But we'll find out more about her. When you first saw the video, you and your colleague, the co-author Alice Auersperg, got this video. I mean, in this day and age, did you think this is not real? This is AI?
Well, that was a possibility, yes. Alice just published a book last year, and she's receiving so many videos from people that think that their animals are using tools. But in most cases, these videos have nothing to do with tools. So we were really surprised when we saw this cow, and it really looked like this cow was using tools in a flexible way. So we jumped on the car immediately, and we drove for 5 hours to the south of Austria from Vienna to meet Veronica.
And what does her home look like?
Well, yeah, she lives in Noss in Geiltal. It's a little town in Carinthia. And it looks like the little town that you would imagine from Austria. If you imagine an Austrian cow, you will imagine these meadows, the mountains, the lakes, the blue lakes, the church and the ringing bells, all these things around Veronica. So it's really a magical place.
People are imagining Sound of Music. People like me are imagining Sound of Music. I've been able to go to Austria and it's beautiful, but it really, it's just stunning and breathtaking.
Exactly. It's the Sound of Music. Exactly. That's the impression that I had.
How long did you have to hang out with Veronica and get comfortable before she started showing off her skills?
Well, that was our first surprise, because we went there expecting to, you know, to be there for several hours or perhaps days waiting for Veronica to use her tool for the first time. But during our first minutes there, Vidgar Vigele, the owner, took a stick, offered it to Veronica. She stretched her tongue, wrapped it around the stick, bring it to her mouth, and she was starting scratching herself. So we almost fall on the ground when we watched that. It was really, really impressive.
And what were you able to learn about Veronica's preferences? I mean, is she using that same sort of, it looks like a broom in the video, or is she using different types of sticks for different itches, different parts?
Yes. See, according to Vidgar, she has two different sticks, one long and one short stick, and she uses one or another depending on the body area that she wants to scratch. So we wanted to test if Veronica was really using tools in a flexible way and in a purposeful way. So the best thing for testing that was finding a broom. The biggest surprise was when we found that she was also using the handle end in a functional, in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
So she was addressing body areas with a broom that were, you know, body areas with hard, thick skin. But when she was scratching those areas of her body where her skin is soft and sensitive, then she was using the handle end, and she was using different techniques when doing so. So really, really impressive.
She is definitely charming and impressive. Why do you think she does this?
Yeah, there is a big message here, of course. Veronica is not a regular cow because she's a pet cow. She has been living for 13 years, and most cows don't reach that age at all.
So she's a lady of leisure, is what you're saying, and she's figured out how to live her life of leisure.
Exactly. She has had the plenty of opportunities to play with so many objects and to interact with her world. So she has learned the possibilities that she has when interacting with this world that she has around her, right? But there is something very important to say about this. We look into the internet to look for other examples. And then I found other examples of cows and bulls doing the same with fallen branches. Both are coming from the aurochs, those bulls that we were hunting and drawing on the walls of caves. And potentially, those aurochs were already having this capability, this potential capability to innovate, to invent how to use tools.
So we've been underestimating the intelligence of cows all this time.
That's the big message, because we have been living with cows for at least 10,000 years, and we know much more about the tool use of those exotic animals, like the cockatoos that we study, that are really good using tools, than what we know about the cows, the animals that have been living with us for so long. And this is because we tend to underestimate the cognitive abilities of those animals that we exploit.
How do you think Veronica and her owner, he might be it easier to get a read on, feel about all of this attention?
Well, her owner, Vidgar, is a great guy, has a strong personality, but he's a bit shy, and he's a bit overblown by the response of the media. And I'm trying to protect him from being contacted too much. And they are really, really happy about the experience.
Antonio, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you to you. Yeah, it was wonderful to be here.
Antonio Osuna-Mascaro is a cognitive biologist at the University of Veterinary Medicine, Vienna, and he's in Vienna. Stones with Beast of Burden.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, New Brunswick Power says the province desperately needs a new gas plant if it wants to avoid blackouts. We'll ask the utility's VP how he responds to the long list of critics who are demanding a different plant.
And murder mystery. A wildlife photographer explains what could be drawing a murder of crows to an Ottawa neighborhood, to the fascination and frustration of residents. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
We'll be right back.
You are listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXC. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, Malachi Coons on Headwaters, featuring a conversation in the 11 o'clock hour that Kari Headland had with Twin Cities DJ Mary Lucia about her recent memoir. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. We also thank Paperstorm, providing on-site paper shredding services to commercial and residential customers throughout central and northern Minnesota. Accepting old paperwork during tax season with secure shredding services. More information at paperstorm.net. Our weather for tonight, 4 below to 6 above. Cloudy tomorrow, chance of snow continues, highs in the teens, with blustery southwest winds up to 20 miles per hour.
As the saying goes, sometimes it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. But if you've tested that out, you know that it's only true sometimes. New Brunswick's primary electric utility, NB Power, is conducting a test of that saying in real time as we speak. As of today, the Crown Corporation seems determined to proceed with construction of a planned 500-megawatt gas plant in a rural part of the province called Tantramar. We told you about that facility as part of our hometown's programming late last year, and we learned about the local opposition it was facing then, opposition that NB Power officials and subcontractors encountered themselves at a recent town hall.
Hi there. I think it's really clear that there's a cascade of issues that are all interconnected that we all know about, and we reject this fully. Like, we do not want it. It just 100% do not want this project.
This project has been fast-tracked. Everyone's been blindsided, including the government, including First Nations.
People who are of the land see ourselves as connected to everything, rocks, trees, fish, birds.
Given what you know about our home, and the opposition of our people to this fossil fuel burning gas turbine plant, can you tell us how social license or public support fits into your decision-making process?
Tantramar, New Brunswick residents Sherry Boyle and Julia Bulmer, Fort Folly First Nation Elder Gene Nye, and the chair of Tantramar's Climate Change Advisory Committee, Doug Bliss, speaking at a town hall meeting about the new gas plant last week. Brad Cody is NB Power's Vice President of Business Development. We reached him in Fredericton, New Brunswick.
Brad Cody, how does public support for this project, social license, fit in to this for you and NB Power?
Yeah, social license, like I said during that very tense and tough public meeting, is that it's absolutely vital, very, very important. We don't take it lightly. We don't take the responsibility to engage people and help understand the details of a project. It's absolutely critical to the project's success. But more importantly, it's a part of our core values, like the fabric of how NB Power treats its customers. We literally have the value laid out as care for our customers, care for our future, care for our people, our teams here at NB Power, and safety at the heart of everything that we do. And we use those values quite near and dear to our heart to help inform that decision-making and help have our attendance in the meeting like we saw here last week in New Brunswick.
But does that mean you will stop it, given how much there's opposition there is?
What I'd say and what I've been telling folks around New Brunswick is when we do these types of projects, it's hard to find unanimous consent for a project. And what we do is we take it to public meetings, to places that people would like to ask us more about the project to help better explain what it is. Right now, there seems to be two things that I heard in those clips. Things are moving faster than people may have appreciated or understood the need to protect energy security in the province. And we're trying to offset that by making NB Power more open to the public to have those questions and those conversations directly. Otherwise, you're met with the fear of the unknown, and we like to make sure that ourselves and the project proponents take the time that's necessary to fully inform the population around all aspects of the project. And just to remind where we are in this project, it's undergoing a provincial environmental impact assessment. We haven't concluded that process yet, and the second thing that's going to play out here in New Brunswick is a completely open to the public economic hearing. Mm-hmm. So that we can evaluate it from an economic aspect to say, is this the right project for New Brunswickers at this time? And we're quite confident that we're there, but definitely appreciate that folks need some time to digest this, and we're happy to make ourselves available and attend those public meetings where we can hear the questions that folks have, to provide the answers that they need to make those decisions.
As those processes play out, I hear what you're saying, that there's always going to be people who don't love an idea, but it seems it's closer at this point to unanimous disapproval than unanimous consent. From where you sit, from where NB Power sits, why are you pushing this project in its form? Why do you feel that it's vital and right for the province?
Yeah, just twofold. So on that room, it was a tough room. It was organized by the Climate Change Committee of the Village of Tantramer. So I'm not surprised to see the amount of opposition from that room, but I think it's important that we maintain balance. I have had many conversations with folks from the region that are supportive of the project as well. Maybe not as vocal, maybe not as out there as some of the people that are opposed to it, but one room isn't a sample of the entire community. On the second thing, we do at our utility something called integrated resource planning. Most, if not all, the utilities across Canada do something similar in terms of how they plan their supply and demand. So a lot of population boom in New Brunswick and a lot of new construction and connections to our grid, which is increasing the load side of the equation. And yet we haven't built any new real dispatchable forms of supply in New Brunswick in over 20 years. So what we're facing now with this growing need is to say, okay, well, how do we prevent New Brunswick from running out of power? And we're building a lot of renewables, but we don't have control over when those renewables will generate. And what we see about many utilities across Canada, it's kind of an all-of-the-above approach, where it's not one solution that's going to cause the energy transition to be achieved. We have to pursue all systems and all fronts. So we're working with customers on energy efficiency and demand reduction programs. We're working on building new renewables. We're currently soliciting for new battery storage technology.
I wanted to ask you about battery storage. Thank you for raising it. It's come up in many of the conversations we've had on this program and in researching the plant. Those who are saying, you know, why not go that route fully? Why not invest in that?
It's a part of the solution, but it's not the most economical solution that we could deliver, and will not allow us to fulfill our mandate and our desire to add more renewables, so wind and solar, to our system. Batteries will not give us the technology that we need for both of those objectives. The one, give us supply, and two, maintain that the ability to keep adding more renewable supply projects to the grid. We have, as part of this combustion turbine project, something that's not really common, I guess, in other projects, what we call synchronous condensers. And what they do is smooth out the fluctuations in the power and protect the stability of the grid. And that's absolutely vital as we move to more renewable-based projects right across Canada.
People we've spoken to in Tantramar have also talked about being frustrated that this is an American fossil fuel company, ProEnergy, a 25-year contract to build and operate this facility. Why give them that, especially in the time we're living in now?
Yeah, so NB Power, we're not a political entity. We happen to be owned by the government of New Brunswick. We did an open solicitation, published it on the government of New Brunswick's website for having more contracts awarded, I guess, is how they solicit for things. And through that process, we had five submissions from four companies. And the company we selected was, at the time in 2024 when we ran this process, was selected as the preferred winner. There's been a lot of political things that happened since that decision was made. Mm-hmm. But at the time, like I reminded folks the other night in Tantramar, we had Prime Minister Justin Trudeau at the time and President Joe Biden, and the political landscape of the world was completely different when these decisions were made.
Just before we let you go, Brad, Premier Susan Holt spoke with our CBC News colleagues for a year-end interview late last year. She says she sympathizes with people who don't want the plant there. Just broadly speaking, though, are you worried that beyond what happened in that room and the others who are dissenting, that political pressure could force the Premier's hand here?
Yeah, from my side, I got to stay at saying, are we doing the right thing based on the constructs that we have in front of us? Are we taking the project and the proponent through a fair EIA or environmental impact assessment? And NB Power has the burden of getting this through the Energies and Utilities Board of New Brunswick. And politics, that's for others to decide. Leave it to them to figure that side out while we look at how do we protect energy security for New Brunswick at the least cost way possible.
I really appreciate this, Brad. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Brad Cody is the Vice President of Business Development for NB Power. We reached him in Fredericton, New Brunswick. depending who you ask, people in Ottawa's Alta Vista neighborhood are either in awe of their new neighbors or appalled by them. In recent days, a sizable murder of crows has moved into the area, settling into the trees in Hitchcockian numbers. And not everyone's happy about that because they don't exactly respect the noise bylaws. Craig Gibson is a wildlife photographer based in Massachusetts who runs the website Winter Crow Roost. He has an idea why the crows might see that neighborhood as prime real estate.
Typically, what they're looking for are mature trees with dense branching, perhaps warmer microclimates, fewer natural predators, and also in these locations, there is reliable food sources where they go out daytime to foraging grounds.
And so how many crows would be in a roost like the one in Alta Vista?
Up in Ottawa, I think the numbers up there have fluctuated between 25 and 30,000 each year based on accurate counts by experienced birders and ornithologists.
And so what is a winter roost? What do they do, these thousands of birds all together at the same time? And why?
So this is a classic winter roost. During the breeding season in the warmer months, the crows are very secretive and they're very territorial. In the wintertime, they gather in these large numbers, typically in Alta Vista or Ottawa. Probably 80% of them are migratory birds from 100 to 500 miles away, and about 20% of them are local. They have no parenting responsibilities. They gather, again, in these huge, large numbers. It's like a party, a winter vacation week for college students down in Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Yeah, you know what? It can get a bit noisy. This is what they're complaining about. So this is a video a resident took of the crows flying overhead one morning. Why do they make such a racket?
When they arrive into the roost, they will come and stage nearby, and about 15 or 20 minutes after the time of sunset, regardless of cloud cover, they will be very noisy coming into the roost, and then by about 45 or 50 minutes after sunset time, they will go all quiet. So it's part of the resettling, reshuffling, back into the big overnight slumber party, maybe trying to find family members.
Hmm.
90 minutes before the time of sunrise, again, independent of cloud cover, they will start with small, lower-level vocalizing murmurings. It'll work its way to a crescendo about 45 minutes before sunrise time. It'll drop off a bit, and then they fly off during the daytime. So it's part of resettling and perhaps rejoicing over another day well spent or preparing for the day ahead. Now, the other thing that's important to know is in all of these cities, it is very usual that the crows will shift the location of the nightly roost four, five, six different times. They will likely shift locations a handful of times during the extended winter season.
Craig Gibson is a wildlife photographer based in Massachusetts. He was talking to Rebecca Zandbergen on Ottawa Morning. And now the moving tale and the moving back tale of a famous rock called Portable. At least it's famous to rock climbers. The 70-pound granite block is roughly the size and shape of a bag of flour. It usually lives in Squamish, BC, in an area called Superfly, a well-known bouldering spot. It sat in the shadow of a much, much larger boulder called Spiderfly. But in September, Portable went missing. And as the weeks and months passed, climbers began to lose hope that they would ever see that nondescript rock again. But now, fantastic news. Ethan Salvo is a rock climber based in Squamish. We reached him in Bishop, California.
Ethan, it might be hard for people to wrap their heads around the fact that a rock is not only beloved, it's famous, and it has a name, and that name is Portable. How did this rock become so beloved and famous?
It's a really great question. Quite honestly, I don't know the full history of it. Portable has definitely been around Squamish a lot longer than I've been alive. But I mean, the how and why somewhat makes sense. I mean, us climbers are pretty weird creatures, and we definitely approach the woods with some love for nature, maybe a little bit too far at times, you could say. But I think portable became love just as like a fun, silly challenge. I mean, it's really just like bouldering in its simplest and smallest form. So it's kind of a fun way to interact with rock.
And how do you interact with everything else?
So, I mean, we interact with portable the way we would like any other boulder. The goal is to get on top, usually through the hardest way you can possibly get on top for some reason. But the portable is about a foot high, and people will usually sit on the ground below the top of portable and then try and press on top of it and stand up. There's like hundreds and hundreds of videos of people doing this on the internet. So that's one way. People also try and lift it off the ground with one hand as like a little strength benchmark. Pro climber Sean Rabatou one year also got on top of the rock without using his hands, and that's been unrepeated since. So there's many ways.
How did you find out that portable was missing?
So climbing's kind of like my full-time thing. So I'm in the boulders quite often, and this past year I was climbing on the Chief in Squamish quite a bit. And to get to the start of the route, I would walk by the boulder that Portable kind of lives at every day that I'd go. And sometime in early September, it just wasn't there. I don't know. It's definitely been moved in the past, but for like a couple days at a time. And so at first we were like, oh, weird. It's gone again. Not the most normal thing, but it'll probably pop back up. And then a week goes by, nothing. Another week goes by, nothing. And then, you know, after like a month or so, it kind of started becoming a concern in the community. Everyone was like really shocked that it was gone and also just confused. I mean, it is kind of silly for this like small rock that means so much to everyone in the area to just vanish. And so that kind of was where it all began, I guess.
So after all of these months, and you're in, as our listeners heard, you're in Bishop, California. You're there on a climbing trip. It's a great place to climb. We hear. I've not been. Mm-hmm. And then something happens last night. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so, I mean, I hadn't thought of the portable in like a month or two, probably. I mean, it's one of those things that gets brought up every now and then. Everyone's like, wow, what happened to it? And I thought it was just gone. And then last night, I get a text from a friend at like 7 p.m. They sent me this Reddit forum. There was a photo of portable under like the most trafficked boulder problem in Bishop, wearing a Canadian drinking toque.
What?
He had some googly eyes on him.
Oh,
yeah, it's
no.
A really sick hat. I'm going to keep it now. It's got a bottle opener built into it. It's cool. But yeah, at first, my first thought was AI, because that's just everywhere these days.
Of course.
And I was like, this just seems like one of those things, like someone thought it'd be funny to make a little AI image and trick everyone. And I was camped maybe like 20 minutes away from the boulder. But I had a friend that was pretty close to it. So I called her last night. And I was like, yo, Rachel, like, apparently portable's under the Ironman Traverse. Like, I think you should run up there and see if it's there.
And what did she say? That's a popular climbing route. We should tell our listeners.
Yeah.
What did Rachel say?
Rachel's like, I'm going there right now. She ran up there from camp. And lo and behold, portable's sitting there in his Canadian drinking too, just chilling. Looking at the landscape, and Rachel picked up the portable for me, took it back to camp, and then we drove up the road, blasting Creed at like 8 p.m. on our big adventure to rescue the portable. And lo and behold, I saw it, and the minute I saw the shape, I knew it was it. It just looked like home. It felt like home. It weighed like home.
How do you know?
And
how do you know for sure?
You just know.
You just know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things, like, rock climbers are weird. We have, like, weird connection to the environment around us. There, if you, like, put me blindfolded in front of a rock and put my hand on a famous hold, I'd know the hold off the bat, probably.
So who do you think did this? I mean, I know you like the toque and you want to keep it. It's just chilling up there. But do you think it was a tribute, or, you know, they're making fun of what you love?
My theory, current theory, is that it was probably someone who doesn't live in Squamish that was there in the summertime, and they took it as a joke before they left for the season. And then I think they probably didn't expect it to blow out of proportion as much as it did. They thought it was probably just going to be funny. And then one day they're just like, well, we're going to send it on a tour, and it showed up in Bishop.
maybe Portable is going to join the circuit for a little bit, but it's been intercepted and will return to the homeland now.
Just to do my due diligence, Ethan, did you have anything to do with Portable's disappearance?
No, I did not. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of people have been asking me that, and yeah. My answer is I'm pretty stupid and have some crazy ideas, but this one's a little above me. It would require me having Portable at my place in Squamish from September till the end of October, and then deciding to bring this 70-pound rock with me in my Subaru Outback that I'm living in, that's already filled to the brim with junk and clothes and a bunch of stuff, and hide this rock from all my friends for months to then place it. It's just like a little bit too outlandish. Yeah.
Ethan, safe travels. Good luck to you in Portable. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll have a great time.
Ethan Salvo is a rock climber from Squamish, BC. We reached him in Bishop, California. A comparison is a good way to conjure up an image in one's mind. Like, if I tell you something is the length of 3 football fields, CFL fields, obviously, or it weighs as much as 6 elephants, or it's the size of a small bathtub. Now, you may not know exactly how big a small bathtub is, but you know potholes should not be that size. And yet, it is how some potholes on British Columbia's Coquihalla Highway are being described. That's an issue for all drivers, of course, but especially commercial truck drivers. Here's BC Trucking Association President Dave Earle.
They're big, they're bad, they're deep, and they're nasty. It's huge, you know, and when you think about this, these are vehicles that are big. They're constructed very, very, they're very strong. However, the potholes that we're seeing are so big and so deep that they're really causing problems for trucks. So you're into thousands of dollars with steering linkages, bent wheels. And more importantly, when these trucks are put out of service, it's not a matter of putting it to the side of the road and, you know, popping it up on a jack and throwing a spare on. That's not how it works. It's a very expensive proposition to change a wheel at the side of the road. Often, Shelley, what we see when these things happen, drivers are really good at seeing these things. You know, they simply just move their axles and go around them, and it's not a big deal. But what happens is when they sneak up on you. What happens is if there's a truck in front of you and the angle of where you're at, you just don't get quite enough warning, you can't avoid it. It happens when small cars, you know, the light vehicles cut in front of trucks and they're focused on that, and then they hit a hole. That's where it's really, really concerning, because that's when we're talking about safety as well. And so they sneak up on you. Like it is very, very difficult. This isn't a case of blaming the driver at all. It's not as easy as it sounds. But what it comes down to is you need to give yourself more time to be able to do that and back off the gas pedal in that area of the highway.
BC Trucking Association President Dave Earle talking to Shelley Joyce, host of Daybreak Kamloops.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.